disposition, that indignity, that pain in the eyes of your parents stays with you forever, and that motivates you. When you taste the tear gas, you know that you can withstand whatever they throw at you.
What made you do that? What inspired you both externally and internally?
And that's why in the US, the campus is turning against the capital. In Europe, the public squares turning against the parliament. And in the Muslim world, the street against the palace. The tyrants become more bellicose, more aggressive, more vicious, like the last kicks of a dying horse.
How much do you think the world misses in terms of not being able to learn from South Africa?
I come from a nation which were probably the last warriors against supremacism. 30 years of continuous war inspired by the USA on the Middle East. There is this ironic symmetry in which South Africa takes Israel to the International Court of Justice on a charge of genocide. And then South Africa is charged and punished by the White House for genocide against whites. Today still, 7% of our population being white owns 72% of the land. It is spitting into the face of black suffering.
I was a student at university.
Oh, okay.
Creating, you know, trying to create trouble. Okay, great.
Okay, let's see what trouble we can create now.
Already, I just want to just give me a couple of your.
Okay, I'm good. I'm counting myself down. 3, 2, 1. Hi, good day, and welcome to another episode of Unapologetic. I'm your host, Ishwar Karim, and I'm very honored today to speak to the former South African ambassador to the USA, Ibrahim Rasool. Ibrahim, welcome to the show.
No, thank you very much. It's a great honor to be unapologetic.
Thank you. So Ibrahim's actually been the ambassador to the USA twice, from 2010 to 2015, and also recently for a very short stay. What was it, like a month, 2 months, 3 months?
2 months, 23 days.
2 months, 23 days. Well, not bad, my guess is. 2 months, 23 days before Donald Trump expelled him for comments that Ibrahim made, which have been backed up recently by the South African foreign minister, and which I think many people feel around the world, even though they were not in the position of ambassadorship, that the Trump government is kind of tending towards white supremacy. That discussion is going to make us discuss. I mean, we're going to start off by discussing that and just your version of events and what went down, but we can end up through that discussion speaking about the world's move to the far right, Donald Trump's presidency and MAGA, obviously the global impact that Israel's genocide on Gaza has had, the implications of that. And I guess we'll also veer into allegations of a white genocide in South Africa. We'll speak a bit about you as well and just about your life and what inspires you. So I'm excited about the conversation. As a South African, I've known about your work for a very long time. And yeah, looking forward to it.
No, thank you very much. That's a daunting shopping list of issues to cover, but let's see where it goes.
Okay, so just to start off with, when I heard that you were going to be the ambassador to the USA, at the same time while there was the ICJ case happening, I know that you are quite outspoken, and I knew that it's, you know, South African, especially now with Trump, there's probably going to be some retaliation because of the ICJ. I was like, this is my own thoughts, nothing against you. I think you're, you know, a very interesting and intelligent man. But this is an interesting appointment. And it lasted shorter than I even thought it would. I thought that this is going to be interesting to see how they navigate this very tough situation. But what was your thoughts on the appointment? And did you think when you hosted that webinar where you said the comments you made, did you think that you will actually be expelled? But before that, what were your thoughts when you were actually appointed?
Look, it was one thing I had to think about quite hard. I asked the president, my president, is he sending me on a suicide mission or does he think that this can be done? He said, it's definitely not a suicide mission. If anyone can do it, you can. And that was the responsibility I took up with me, and I understood that I'm going to need to understand transactionality more than the kind of values-driven diplomacy. I understood that I can't compromise, for example, and that's a very explicit question, I can't compromise on South Africa's charging of Israel with genocide in the ICJ, but I can speak about turning down the megaphone so that we allow the case to speak for us rather than us making the kind of grand speeches about Palestine. that got me into trouble with some of the progressive elements, particularly the Muslim elements, who said, why must we turn down? I said, no, you don't turn down the megaphones. The government turns down the megaphone. We put our case there, let it rest.
Yes.
And so I knew, but I had a sense of dread from the moment I was announced in November already, because then the lobbies turned up their megaphones.
The lobbies in the USA or in South Africa?
APAC. Okay. Began to call me a Hamas supporter. They began to speak about me being an Islamist and all of those kind of things, called me a terrorist sympathizer and so forth. The South Africans around Trump, like Joel Pollack, who's the editor-at-large for Breitbart, he really started to make this a news item, promising that Trump will never credential me, and so forth. Jewish Report started writing, and even Jews in South Africa, like the Jewish Board of Deputies, had to find very garbled ways of saying, no, he was actually a very okay person. While he was the premier here, we had a great time here, but I don't know what went wrong. What went wrong was the genocide, and so forth. And when I arrived there, they were very surprised that in Biden's last week, he credentialed me in his last intake of ambassadors with enormous fanfare. Yep. But that's because I knew the system quite well, and they felt outmaneuvered that I got credentialed. They had hopes of keeping
me. They meaning the lobbies, the Israeli
the
lobbies.
MAGA crowd.
Okay, the MAGA
if
crowd.
I can put it like that, the APAC MAGA crowd felt outmaneuvered that I had enough networks in the US. And by the time they wiped out their eyes, I, in a month, had entered the doors of 22 Congress members and senators. I was speaking at different churches. I was addressing think tanks in the USA. I was speaking to business associations and all of those kind of things. And they knew that, on the one hand, my networks from my 7 years in the USA, plus the natural constituency South Africa has in the USA arising out of the anti-apartheid movement, that all of that was really kicking in, and the access that they thought they were denying me to the White House and the State Department was being made up in abundance with those kind of networks. So I knew that there was a difficulty, and I could speak with a moral authority about not compromising on our case in the ICJ. I could explain very clearly why we will not leave BRICS, and I could really make the case for continued aid and trade with South Africa, because I've been through those discussions before. I was not a novice in Washington. And so at the end of the day, I was never rude or crude, but I was impactful in the way in which I was accessing US society.
Okay, so just, I just want to kind of try to understand, those 2 months and 23 days. So you've now I mentioned this before, but the audience may not be aware. So you were an ambassador for 5 years, appointed by Jacob Zuma. This is when Obama was in charge of the country, and very effectively, right? And as you mentioned, you built up your networks, and you kind of knew how the State Department and everything works. So this was a new terrain for you. And then you spend your 2 months, 23 days, kind of trying to access the White House. My understanding from the reports I recollect is that every meeting you tried to, basically you were shut down. You weren't allowed access to meet senators, to meet people, which you've kind of alluded to. And then, you know, at the same time, Elon Musk is turning on the volume. There's the white genocide stuff, which starts. And then in many ways, what you say in the webinar is a response to that. How calculated were you, and what was sort of your mindset going into this? Was your mindset like, you know, you've kind of accepted that there's no access and you're just going to be very, very frank? Did you not expect a reaction? Or was it like, I'm actually going to try to goad them by being a bit outspoken and then see what the reaction is so that we can start opening up doors? Like, what was the rationale when you said that?
No, the one thing you must understand is that I actually did get through 22 senators and Congress members, and that surprised them. I did get into officials in State Department, and that surprised them. Same thing with access to the White House. We did find people who wanted to speak. So, in a sense, it was being successful despite the shutdown.
Okay.
The second thing that I think is important is the timelines. I spoke late in March on that webinar, but you must remember that the first punishment of South Africa happened the night that Donald Trump was inaugurated.
Yes.
When he started to cut down climate funds and aid and so forth. So that was before I said anything.
Yes, 100%.
His entertainment of white South African supremacists, AfriForum and Solidarity, and to some extent the Democratic Alliance in the White House happened before I said anything. His February 20th executive order alleging a white genocide, alleging land confiscation of whites, alleging oppression of whites, and therefore cutting off all PEPFAR money, which is the money we use to fight HIV and AIDS, and so forth, happened before I said anything about it. And then finally, the tariffs were imposed before I said anything. So the idea that the ambassador said something and therefore we were punished is a false idea, because the timeline proves differently. And so that, I think, needs to be clarified. What I said was an explanation of
the actions that
of the actions and the punishment we were receiving. It was an explanation about how do you deport black and brown from the US, but you import white South African refugees into the US. Is a explanation about why the official access to the White House is shut down, but your kind of white Afrikaner supremacists are allowed to come and have the discussions that generate the false narratives about genocide and so forth. And very importantly, it's an explanation about how there is this ironic symmetry in which South Africa takes Israel to the International Court of Justice on a charge of genocide, and then South Africa is charged and punished by the White House for genocide against whites. How South Africa takes Israel to the ICJ for land occupation, and the charge from the White House and the punishment from the White House is for South Africa taking away land from whites, and the same with South Africa charging Israel with the oppression of Palestinians, and we are charged and punished by Trump for so-called oppression against our white minority. And so the absolute symmetry of the charges against us and the punishment for us, you only have to be stupid not to understand that as an ambassador. And then when you have to explain to the policymakers in your country and to the decision makers, the traders in your country and the government of your country and the intelligentsia of your country, what is at stake? You can dumb down yourself, or you could, in a very sophisticated way, explain to them what is at work so that they don't chase the negotiating tactics for how, if we do this, we can get our fruit in. If we do that, can we still get our cars in? Because we were chasing our tails when they don't understand, and the words that I used, the supremacist instinct that is driving, and the intersecting supremacisms at work, because there's the MAGA white supremacism in the USA, drawing on a nostalgic residual supremacism from Afrikaners in South Africa, who now find a power plug in the US, coinciding with a Zionist supremacism that absolutely hated the idea that we took Israel to the International Court of Justice. And those intersecting supremacisms, if you only unpack that, then you begin to find a strategic response to what is at stake. And I'm very happy that out of almost 200 ambassadors, one ambassador's fairly sophisticated analysis of what was at stake had an unmasking effect, and therefore a disturbing effect on the Oval Office. And I think that for me is why I described it as a badge of honor.
Okay. So, I mean, as you were speaking, before you showed the asymmetry, like it was clear, like it's, the asymmetry between the charges that you have taken to the ICJ on Israel and what Donald Trump is throwing at you. I mean, there's so much I want to unpack about this. I mean, one of the things I'm going to ask about is just how does the atmosphere that you experience now change to the atmosphere you had on the Obama years, but even at that 1 week when Biden was in charge. Not that, and we're going to get to, Joe Biden's complicity itself in the genocide. So not that, the Democrats were behaving in an honorable way at all. They were as responsible, if not more responsible, for the genocide when it started, definitely. Just if you can just speak to, because I'm South African, and so I'm quite aware that the charge of white genocide is pretty ridiculous. But just our audience may not be, so... tell us why it's ridiculous.
It's an absolutely ridiculous charge because there's crime in South Africa, and it's an unfortunate situation that black and white and brown are dying in South Africa. And the most deaths happen in a township on a Friday and a Saturday night, alcohol fueled, gangster fueled, and just wanton violence that I think that comes. And that's largely because we have not reconstructed the South African soul after apartheid. And so that is something that the ANC and people like myself must carry responsibility for. So the point is that there's been an enormous amount of crime. Have there been white farm murders? Yes, there have been. In the last 5 years, the count has been 38 white farmers who have been murdered on their of white farm community members who have been murdered, but they've also been murdered by white farm owners of their black workers for picking up a fruit from the floor and eating it, being dragged on by their hands on from a pickup van until they die. And so the point of the matter is that there have been, but it's been a matter of 38 in the last few years, and so that is that. I think the idea further that the ANC's and the government's land reform process has stripped, it's been a matter of black disappointment that we've developed the legislation for it and never really enacted it, because today still 7% of our population being white owns 72% of the land. The idea of empowerment removing economic activity and wealth from whites is another blight on post-apartheid South Africa, because 7% of the population being white own 90% of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. And so it's an absolutely ridiculous charge. It is spitting into the face of black suffering to even allege that whites suffer in South Africa.
Okay, so... going now to your Obama years, right? I mean, not your Obama years, but when you were the ambassador when Obama was in charge. Now, there's so much. I mean, Trump came to power the first time before there was a genocide. And Trump's racist rhetoric, the rhetoric of MAGA would have occurred despite Israel's genocide, I'm pretty sure of. I mean, I don't know if he would have got to the White House again. I do think that without doubt, I mean, we can't really say this, we can't calculate it, but the Biden's reaction to the war, and then later on his inability to speak coherently, and then Kamala's just imposition on the Democrats probably had a big role in also losing the election. But it was clear that there was a Trump 2.0 already on the rise, right? So from your analysis, how we'll get to the impact Gaza genocide has had on it, but outside of the Gaza genocide, the way the USA has gone right in the last sort of 15 years, what's behind it? What's at its core? Is it just this idea, what you mentioned? I think you said white residual something, right? You just said it earlier on.
Supremacism from South Africa.
Exactly, right? Is it this idea that America is losing its whiteness? Is it ideological? Where does this resurgent, and it's not just been in America, it's been in other places, but where do you see it coming from?
So you see, we live in a world in which there's enormous mobility of capital. We press a button and money moves. Of goods, we place an order and the goods arrive. But at the same time, there's this enormous mobility of people. And the mobility of people is in part occasioned by 30 years of continuous war inspired by the USA on the Middle East, and particularly the Muslim world and the black world. And so when you create that instability, people move because now they have the mobility to move. And when people move, you create an enormous number of isms and phobias to deal with each of the diversity that is moving into your country, seeking a better life and seeking peace from the havoc that you've created in their homelands, whether Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, or whatever the case may be. And so that's the cause of it. And the cause of continuously having to do war is because the USA, despite its own values at home, the USA has given the Muslim world a triple bypass of human rights, democracy, and freedom. And have said, let the despots look after you. Because what we need from you is to accept Israel, and we need your fossil fuels. And so the fact of the matter is that in pursuit of the U.S. interests, they've compromised what they hold as U.S. values. And that is true for Democrats and Republicans. Both have presided over a 30-year continuous war in the last while. I'm not even speaking about the earliest part of the 20th century. So having said all of that, when people then move into the USA, their mobility creates xenophobia, particularly for Hispanics, Islamophobia for Muslims, racism for blacks. And so we can go on how we've spawned all these isms and phobias, and therefore what we need to understand out of that is that Trump then comes in. But Trump comes in as what I call an insurgent force. There's a so those of us who know the methodology of struggle would see that there's a pre-insurgency. When I arrive in the USA, the pre-insurgency is very much at work, and it's called the Tea Party.
Tea Party, yep.
Then the Obama years tied over because the pre-insurgency is fueled by the idea that there's a black president. Never mind that he commands in much the same way as a white president. He just hesitates sufficiently during the first iteration of the Arab Spring. But a year after the Arab Spring begins to take root, he allows the counter-revolution to happen and can't even say the word coup d'etat. So
I think eventually he does call it a coup. It was an issue of contention. But initially he doesn't, yes.
He doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
But he allows it.
Yep.
And like Kamala Harris, it's hindsight that says, I should have said this about Netanyahu. Obama, in hindsight, says that was a coup. But be that as it may. So you've got the pre-insurgency. The Obama years fuels that pre-insurgency, and therefore the reaction to him is what is called the incipient insurgency, Trump 101. But the incipient insurgency is not coherent yet, doesn't understand the levers of power, doesn't have the kind of money at his command to threaten as he wants, doesn't have the amplification of the social media that he requires, and he doesn't have the levers to the State Department, the White House, and all the policy instruments of that to dislodge what he calls the deep state. And so he bumbles about, particularly with a pandemic, and holds court, but shows his unfitness to exercise the levers of power globally and domestically. And so, as he loses the election, you actually have a moment of the open insurgency, the January the 6th, the armed militias that move in, that shows that the insurgency is very much alive, but it is now almost like the mountains of Tora Bora and the deserts of Raqqa. It's a ragtag. And then uses the 4 years out of power to plan and execute and to understand what he lacked in the incipient insurgency and what he needs for the phase that I think we're in now, the resolution phase of the insurgency. He then gets these South Africans like Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Joel Pollack, David Sacks. He gets that to give him the money, the social media, the agenda, and the right words for his attitude against DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and so forth. And therefore, Trump 202 enters the resolution phase. How do you now use power? But the enemies are phased. In the Tea Party, through the incipient insurgency, the first enemies are the incumbents in the Republican Party. You destroy the old Republican GOP royalty, like the Cheneys, the Bush. You eclipse the Reagan Republicans. You get rid of the Mitt Romneys. You make a mistake with your vice president and so forth. And those are the levers, the incumbents, who push back on your agenda in the first term. But by the second term, you correct all of that. You've defeated those incumbents, and now you are defeating the incumbency in the Democratic Party, represented by Biden, who proclaims himself a Zionist, represented by Kamala Harris, who doesn't have a clue about what it is that she's fighting, who are out of touch with the mood on the ground. So Trump is in touch with a rightward move on the ground that wants the blacks and the browns out. He's in touch with it and he mobilizes it, he harnesses it. Kamala Harris and the Democrats are out of touch with the feelings on the ground in progressive circles about the genocide, about the assault on the Middle East, about the assault on human rights globally, and they miss that moment completely to reimagine themselves and to re-platform themselves completely. And so that's the phase of the insurgency we find ourselves in.
Okay, so I mean, just listening to your entire analysis, I mean, there's just the question that comes to my mind is actually, it's a bit playful, but it's not on script, but I'll ask it anyway. It's that I've spoken to a few ambassadors, very few are as analytical as you are, and how related do you think that is due to the fact that your political blooding was in the South African struggle?
No, it's absolutely related, because I come from a nation which were probably the last warriors against supremacism. We've got all the DNA of resisting supremacism in us. You know, I say, when you see a piece of wood, you suspect it could become a door. When you see a handle on it, you say, it looks like it's going to be a door. When you see hinges on it, you say, it's resemb-. When you see it opening and shutting, you say, this is a door. And so, when you see a language of dehumanization against darker and other faiths and darker people, you begin to say, this is seeming supremacist. When you start seeing the mobilization of whites against that, you say, it's probably supremacism. When you see, for example, the evidence of your eye that they're deporting black and brown, they're importing white Afrikaner refugees from South Africa. When you see, for example, South Africa being punished and they use your white community in South Africa as the victimhood justification, that if we don't fight back as whites, we will become as disempowered as the whites in South Africa. We will be the people who will be punished. Our land will be taken away. We will be killed like flies if we don't stand up as whites. Then you know you are a supremacist. But if you want the proof of it, you begin to see that it is amongst all that madness, there is a method, because you export that supremacism. You go and safeguard it in Israel, but you come and you send your people to embrace Nigel Farage. Your vice president goes to campaign for Alternativ für Deutschland before he goes to the Munich Forum. Viktor Orban is your invited guest. You reach out to you say to Malay, here's 40 billion for you to stabilize. You tell Lula, free Bolsonaro of all your charges. When Le Pen, Marine Le Pen, is charged in France for incitement and other infringements, you fight for her. So the fact of the matter is that we are not dealing with a local movement. We are dealing with the export of a supremacism and the building of a global, attempted building of a global coherence around it.
Okay, so I mean, I'm gonna say a bunch of things, and they for me and for you, just to kind of keep us on the goalpost, because I want this conversation to be organic, but also I do want to cover a few things. So, I wanna get back to discussing Israel, and because you see, Israel is an interesting moment because there's this formation of the Tea Party, which is not, I mean, white supremacy starts long before the Tea Party, as we both know.
No, absolutely.
And then Israel is this manifestation of white supremacy that's a massive, has its legacy in colonialism. And there's the embracing of Israel by Democrats, which has a certain flavor. And then there's the bracing and unembracing of Israel by white supremacists in America, which is, and I say unembracing because MAGA, you know, elements, Tucker Carlson's probably been the most preeminent, but even Charlie Kirk, you know, who was definitely a white supremacist, called what Israel is doing in Gaza ethnic cleansing. And Tucker Carlson's been much more vociferous, compared to him in against Israel, but mainly from a perspective of, you know, this is not our war, it's America first. Trump came as an America first president. We don't want to be, you know, blowing up people in the Middle East. We want to be looking after American interests. So now there's this fomenting white supremacy which has allowed Israel to do this genocide, which is 300, 400 years old. And then there's this more rabid form of white supremacy, which is Trump. But at the same time, through its protectionism, is anti-Israel. Like, how does this just add some, I mean, you know, or maybe correct what I've said, but just add your analysis to that.
The default position of white Christian-based supremacism is anti-Semitism. Whether it was Hitler who hated the Jews, Mussolini who did that, or even the early iterations of the Ku Klux Klan, the antecedents of American white supremacism in the Ku Klux Klan, their default position has always been anti-Semitism. Intervening in that because of the importance of the U.S. as superpower for the defense and the establishment of Israel is a very systematic program to marry Christian evangelism with Zionism, with the construction of the story that for Jesus Christ to return to earth, the Palestinians need to be pacified and Israel needs to be established. So whatever we think about what Israel did to Jesus, whether they love Christians or whatever the case may be, Jesus' return is preconditioned by Israel's success. So it's a very contrived but plausible thing that creates that marriage between right-wing evangelical Christians with Zionist supremacism, and it holds by and large as Israel is supported, but the slip shows from time to time because it is a default position to be anti-Semitic, but it takes an enormous force of being scripted to remain. So that's the point that I make. And so when there are things that present themselves as the evidence of your eyes about 60,000 Palestinian deaths, when you do see that the church in Bethlehem is violated by Israel before Christmas, when you do hear of Christians being killed because they also resist Zionist occupation, then the slip will show until you're drawn back into line. And so I don't think that there is at this point. I think that there are what I would call tactical schisms happening, but not strategic schisms. You have tactical and occasional uncoupling, but not strategic and institutional uncoupling that is happening.
Okay, explain to us the difference.
The difference is that the Charlie Kirk will say, that's terrible what's happening there. But that will be a tactical difference. Marjorie Taylor Greene will have a tactical difference. Can't Netanyahu behave himself? He's making it impossible to support him. You will have a tactical difference. Why did you bomb Qatar? We told you Qatar is our ally. Now you're going to get it. You will have a tactical difference. Don't make the starvation so evident. You can't invite people to fetch food and then shoot them. Those are tactical differences, and you will hear tactical things that sound like uncoupling. But at the end of the day, it's not strategic. It's not about whether Israel must finish the job or not. It's not about whether there must be a depopulation of Gaza or not. It's not about whether there must be a Palestinian state with integrity or not. Those are the strategic coherences that endure despite tactical moments of uncoupling.
Okay, so because I've had this discussion a few times, and it's also become very revealing to me. Like, so I call it the difference between the fox and the jackal. In South Africa, we used to say it's the difference between the Buddha and the Englishman. You know, that the one is very forthright, and they're less concerned about the optics or how, and the other one is deeply, it was also, you know, they're very much concerned about the optics because this is what gives them the flex that they are the superior civilization.
Yeah.
But then, you know, they are still continuing your annihilation, just in a better way. But again, and I'm going to just push a bit more on this, while I do agree with you, like, for example, I mean, Tucker Carlson, who I think is, you know, a problematic person and has very problematic ideas on the Israel issue, has been extremely, extremely, like, I mean, he's said things which are arguably as articulate as any pro-Palestinian person that have said. And he's invoked Christianity. He's called out the evangelical Christians. I agree, it's not on the level where it's a decoupling from, I wouldn't say it's not strategic, but it's not a decoupling from the default white supremacist position. But I mean, where do you think, and I'm asking you to be a bit of a prophet here, but where do you think this takes the MAGA movement? Or do you think this is a blip, and Israel, as it tones down, it continues its grand atrocity of ethnic cleansing, but it tones down the extent of the atrocity. Do you think this kind of fades into the background?
While I would say that it remains tactical schisms and not strategic ruptures, every tactical schism could, if treated collectively in a opportunistic way, if I can put it like that, can become the kind of prelude to something strategic. Tucker Carlson multiplied, added to Marjorie Taylor Greene, added to the legacy of Charlie Kirk, added to a number of voices, could be the beginning of the rupture that we want, simply because as Trump's base begins to say, why are your tariff wars, meaning that our soybeans are not being sold to China anymore, we are going bankrupt. As middle America's shopkeepers are saying, no, you're killing us with your tariffs, as they realize they actually pay for the tariffs, I think we are setting up with a number of tactical schisms that I think, if managed correctly, could lead to something different. I think the fact that a Mamdani has gathered together a critical mass of young, particularly young voters, I think is beginning to be worrying. The fact that in this little November elections, Democrats showed, whether they were socialist democrat or democratic socialist like Mamdani, or center left as in other places, I think it is beginning to be worrying, and therefore there are more people prepared to say, we think Trump's strategy may not be the right one. It could be short-lived, and therefore we need to do something. What's helping them is the incoherence of the Democrats. Having said all of that, I don't discount these discords. I'm just saying don't overestimate it, and therefore part of our response must be to deepen those kind of rifts in much the same way that when we heard, for example, little voices amongst editors in the Afrikaner community, we invited them to Dakar to deepen the rift. When we saw that the rugby players were saying, why can't we play against the All Blacks any longer? We invited them to Lusaka to meet with the liberation movement. When we saw that the academics in South Africa were beginning to have tactical differences with the apartheid project, we turned those tactical differences into a strategic alternative for them. And that, I think, is the kind of way in which we must treat all these little voices that at this point constitute tactical schisms and hopefully turn it into a strategic rupture.
I mean, I'm presently reading I thought I wasn't going to bring this up into the interview, but anyway, I will. I'm presently reading a biography of Oliver Tambo by Lulu. She's a journalist.
Kulenikos.
Yes. And it's just, and I'm reading about...
The Engeli Mountains.
Yes, it's fantastic. It's just unbelievable. It's just... So I read the book because I read Long Walk to Freedom about two or three times. I've read the biography of Sabukwe, and I said, I want to now learn about the struggle, you know, what we built in Zambia and in Dar es Salaam and in London to dismantle apartheid. And it really blows my mind. Not that Long Walk to Freedom and what happened in Robben Island and Mandela's behavior doesn't blow my mind, but this amazing strategic ability to understand how to dismantle things and then to have the commitment to figure it out and the sacrifice and to start armed struggle and to word all of those things. I mean, it's really quite phenomenal how, you know, the ability of South Africa's legacy to dismantle these supremacies. Now, we're currently living in a world where I see this, and you obviously do, and I think many South Africans, but even non-South Africans, people of all shades of colors, see how white supremacy is really, you know, it's had the world in its clutches for 400 years, but it's really expressing itself, and I think Gaza has brought that to light. How much do you think the world misses in terms of not being able to learn from South Africa, or do you see the lessons that we were able to do and the way we behaved in the 60s, 70s, 80s to dismantle apartheid? Do you see a resistance? Do you see global movements? Do you see different tactics? Do you see that there's mobilization happening outside of South Africa against this global white supremacy, where these tactics are being adopted and learned? And you know, I mean, Mamdani is an example of it, but it's very different because it's very isolated to New York. But what's your response to that?
I addressed the Dutch Africa Day celebration on Saturday. And I recalled coming to the Netherlands in 1990 to prepare our Dutch comrades in the anti-apartheid movement for the transition. And I recalled how they were skeptical about whether this transition was really going to happen, given the fact that there's states of emergency, there's brutality. And it's true. More people died in the last 10 years before the election, right up to the moment of the 1994 election, which made Mandela president. More people died. More soldiers were in the townships. More siege was laid on the townships, and so forth. And more brutality in the homelands happened. And the point that I made is the point that I will make today. It is that the tyrants become more bellicose, more aggressive, more vicious, like the last kicks of a dying horse. Now, I'm not saying we are at that point yet, But their bellicosity, the sound and fury of a Trump, the assertiveness of an Orban, the surge of a Farage, the sullenness of a Marine Le Pen, and the absolute mission to annihilate of the Israeli government led by Netanyahu, all of that may lead us to believe that they are at the height of their powers. That is the last of their tactical interventions that we are seeing. They are retreating into the sphere where they are undoubtedly stronger than us, which is the hard power, because they are conceding that they have lost the battle for soft power, the morality. South Africa's intervention in the ICJ, whatever the outcome, whether we win the case or not, we have already won, because in an evidence-based way, we took Israel to the International Court of Justice and we shred up the veneer of civilization. We put evidence, and they are asking for more time to study our evidence, because we did not go with hearts filled with rage and solidarity to the ICJ. We went with pages and reels of film and so forth to the ICJ as proof that the genocide is there. We have shown in the ICJ how the history of the Palestinians as a people are being obliterated, their artifacts and everything, as one of the signs of trying to kill the history of a genealogy, a Palestinian one. We are showing that the 60,000 deaths currently and all those over the Nakba are attempts to kill the present population of that genealogy. And we are showing that the focused attacks on children, on pregnant mothers, is an attempt to wipe out the future of that genealogy. And so what is happening that gives me the hope is that the citizens of the world are responding. And that's why in the US, the campus is turning against the Capitol. In Europe, the public squares turning against the parliament. And in the Muslim world, the street against the palace. And what we are beginning to see is that we have won the battle for morality, and the battle of soft power has been won through that intervention in the ICJ, and is manifesting itself across the world, so that New Yorkers vote for Mamdani, and French citizens say to their president, go and recognize a Palestinian state. It may not amount to much, but I think, like we learned during the anti-apartheid struggle, that the citizens lead the way and the governments follow later in order for those parties to survive.
You mentioned the ICJ. You've spoken a bit about the U.S. retaliation to South Africa taking up the cause of the Palestinian cause to the ICJ and accusing Israel of genocide. What other retaliations have there been? I'm sure there have been retaliations from other parts of the world, Israeli allies, Europe, etc.
The retaliation against South Africa from the U.S. is absolutely damaging. The ability of black South Africans to absorb the punishment is being tested to the utmost as we speak. I was in the Eastern Cape a few weeks ago, where a tire factory had to close because the tariffs are too much, where the automotive industry is slowing down because the tariffs and the end of the African Growth and Opportunities Act means that the cars don't easily flow that way. There are places in the Western Cape where farm workers will have to forfeit their jobs because the oranges are not going to the US markets any longer. We are sitting with 8 billion rands worth of HIV AIDS money being withheld since February. And we are anticipating 137,000 AIDS-related deaths that we must plan for over the next few months. 20,000 healthcare workers out of work because the funding from USAID has ended. That we have 200 NGOs and health clinics closing down. The reinfection rates are going to be phenomenal. And so we can go, and I've been to Zanzibar to respond to the kind of collapsing of the health system because that money has been pulled out. So the fact of the matter is that we are sitting with enormous punishment from the USA, and black South Africans are bearing the brunt of that. So the price for our solidarity is absolutely enormous. The price for doing the right thing at the ICJ is absolutely great that we are paying. And so we need that relief. We've not, for example, seen the Muslim world coming up and saying, okay, we're going to take all our holidays to South Africa just to infuse the service industries to make up a little bit for what you are for what you are losing. So I think the price is really high. I think that commendably, I must say, that where we have lost climate money, some parts of Europe have come in to replenish that. I must say that China has stepped into the breach quite well with some of our health money that we require. China is buying 5 of the fruits that we used to export to the USA. And so in a very real way, there are attempts, but nothing can match the disposable capital that the USA has to do it. But we are now at the point where we are taking out insurance policies. We would have liked the transition to self-reliance to be a bit longer, but we have to act as we can within what we are doing. But never doubt the price that South Africans are paying, and now we are paying the price also with the way in which Israel is wanting to put us on the spot with for example, the planes that are just landing with Palestinians in South Africa.
Okay. I mean, I wanna speak more about the planes, and we can unpack that and sort of speak about how it's in a way a retaliatory sort of almost a snub at South Africa. Like my sense when I heard about that, it was first like, oh, you took us to the ICJ. Oh, you know, why don't you deal with our ethnic cleansing? But we'll discuss that more in depth. But just first to kind of play a bit of devil's advocate. Well, I do agree that there's retaliation from the USA on South Africa because of the ICJ case. There's another voice which says, but the tariffs are universal to a large extent. Trump is cutting U.S. aid around the world. So there's that argument to be made. Like, so how much do you, because I mean, there would still be a withdrawal from U.S. aid irrespective, I would think, without the ICJ. Maybe the ICJ is making it more difficult for South Africa to reverse that or to make the case to sort of allow more funding to come through. But that's one part of the question. And then the other is, you mentioned, you know, China is buying 5 fruits from South Africa that would usually go to the USA. I mean, in a way, this is kind of blowback for the USA because BRICS will now become more aligned, will be incentivized to work together. We've already seen the fact that Saudi Arabia and the UAE want to join BRICS, and so all of these other entities that required American trade now start looking for other partners, and that process is accelerating. So where do you think that leaves US power?
So it's true that tariffs are fairly universal. South Africa's got a little bit of a triple whammy of tariffs. It's got the effective de facto ending of the African Growth and Opportunities Act, yep, which allowed 2,000 goods to go into America duty-free. So suddenly there's that. Then there's the 30% on top of that. And then there is the threatened 10% because of our membership of BRICS. And then there is the implosion of LDC economies within us and around us. Lesotho, for example, has a 50% tariff. Its government has had to declare a state of emergency to just manage the social fallout of that. But South Africa has to carry the contingency of Lesothoans coming into South Africa, Zimbabweans coming into South Africa, Swazis coming into South Africa, seeking that better life, and then accelerating the kind of internal competition for that happens amongst communities mired in scarcity. So I think that's the kind of impact that we have had to face, and we are probably the ones whose reputation is also being maligned with the white genocide story, which then makes it more difficult for private companies, because they never know where is Trump going to go to with the story, what will he do next, and therefore should I invest in South Africa? And so in that regard, that uncertainty with that rhetoric is damaging in a multiplied way. And so I think that's on the first part of your question. Just remind me of the second
part. Is about the acceleration of BRICS.
So that's part of South Africa's response. What contingency scenario does it follow? It doesn't have China's leverages for a retaliation scenario. There is no possibility of a mutuality scenario, because the US just doesn't get onto equal terms with us. We can't surrender because the stakes are too high on the ICJ case, our relationship with BRICS and so forth, that the US wants us to surrender on. And we've tried the appeasement. Our president went to the White House with two white Afrikaner golfers and a white Afrikaner millionaire and say, Johan Rupert.
Billionaire, sorry.
Johan Rupert, please tell him we're not that bad. We tried the appeasement route. It didn't work. So we're now in that fifth scenario called the contingency. And the contingency says, how do you change the global atmosphere that makes it uncomfortable for white supremacists to rule the roost again? And so you've got to build a multilateral system. You've got to diffuse the power of the United Nations Security Council, the IMF, World Bank architecture that charges Africans 9% interest rate and Europeans 3% interest rates on loans and so forth. You've got to change that atmosphere. But you can only change that atmosphere if you build a multilateral system. So how do we transform BRICS from its original intent of a socio-economic emerging market alliance to a much more geopolitical entity that can give cover to other middle-income countries like South Africa, that can take the collective power of a China, a Russia, and Brazil, and India, and aggregate around it other countries that can stand up. So in a sense, BRICS is forced to find a geopolitical coherence. However, we don't have enough of the leverages to cock a snoot at the US, because we have allowed the US financial system and the dollar to become the trading system of the world. And we saw the reaction of the US, which was part of what I had to deal with when I went there, to the use of the word de-dollarization at the BRICS summit in Johannesburg. And a thought once thought can't be unthought. And so the idea that there is a de-dollarization agenda coming in from the future is certainly one that I think the US is dealing with. But we are experimenting in small ways, that when we buy stuff from China, we try to pay in yuan. When they buy stuff from us, they try to pay in rand, so that we kind of overcome the weaponization of the dollar and the US financial system in small ways without declaring war, until we rebuild it. And then finally, how do we utilize inter-regional economic alliances to strengthen ourselves? And so on the one hand, the African Union and ASEAN need to be in conversation. The African Union needs to reach out to Mercosur in South America. We need the EU to say we know that your security and other things are very much integrated with the US, but we need to open your markets, because if you continue to put all your eggs into the US market, someone may upset the bully very soon. And so I think all of those things are happening, but BRICS seems to be the fulcrum around which a lot of those kind of contingency planning is happening.
Okay, so just one more question on this before we move to Israel and more overtly speak about them and the plane they sent, but I think that's a larger conversation on what they've actually done in ethnic cleansing. So, I mean, you've kind of doubled down in this interview with explaining the grand strategy to kind of avoid the U.S. choking of South Africa. On the weekend, the foreign minister was quoted by CNN as talking about how, you know, Trump's, I mean, I think it was related to actually what's going to happen with the G20 and Trump not appearing, but he was specifically pushed on white genocide and said this is clearly a white supremacist agenda, as you've mentioned. Do you think this doubling down is verbally, do you think it's tactful? Or is this the tactic to actually double down publicly and be like, we are now, you know, we need to go on the offensive?
Before I left, Trump punished us, and I explained that. After I left, he had his, he doubled down on the tariffs, even though we went with an appeasement agenda to the White House, as our president did, and as I explained. So we've tried the appeasement route. It's not done anything. We've, even as we led the discussions to the G20, we kind of collapsed the ambitious agenda we had about revitalizing the global South in this G20, completing 4 years of Global South leadership of the G20, starting with India, Indonesia, Brazil, and now South Africa. We've built up to this crescendo, and then South Africa had to say, listen, we're not going to achieve this. What we want to achieve on climate, go to COP30. What we want to achieve on other things, let's work with the UN agencies. Let's stick to the financial economic agenda for this G20. So we gave in to Trump's idea that we've widened the G20 too much. He then said that his vice president will come. We said, no, that's great. Let's go. Let's find a declaration that is comfortable for the US as well. They've now said they're not even going to entertain a declaration or a communique. If President Ramaphosa wants to end the G20, he should simply have a chairperson's statement. So every attempt at appeasing has not worked. And I can say in the 7 months since my departure and this weekend when our minister said what I said, if I can put it like that, that this e-supremacy, I think that they have certainly tried the appeasement route, and now we are saying, okay, there's nothing we can do about this man. He's, in fact, repeating the idea of a white genocide, etc., etc. So there's just malafides. There's just bad faith that is involved here. Our president, when he was asked, now that Trump is saying none of the Americans are coming and he's taken Argentina with him, what are you saying? He says, no, that's their loss. We'll continue. So in a sense, I think we are doubling down on the contingency scenario. We are going to take out an insurance policy not to do that. And I think, you know, if we are more diplomatic about the supremacy issue, we would be silent. And if we are silent on such an obvious matter, we are compliant. We are giving tacit approval that what Trump is saying is the truth. And South Africa cannot afford that.
Okay. So this weekend, I mean, it was actually Friday night, I think, or Friday afternoon, a plane arrived in Johannesburg Airport. 153 Palestinians were on board. initially it was suspected that, you know, I mean, they were kept on the plane, and now we know that's because it was unsure how they got there, and this may be a form of ethnic cleansing. But initially there were some criticisms, because why are these Palestinians who are clearly in, you know, have humanitarian needs been kept on a plane? It's now clear that you know, this is Israel somehow got these Palestinians to pay quite an exorbitant amount of fees, got transported to Israel. They were then put on a plane. They weren't sure where they were going, and they ended up in South Africa. Why do you think Israel chose South Africa? Because Israel decided where they're going. I think that's related to the ICG. But secondly, just how, because when it came to me, the two things came to my mind. This is some sort of smack back at the ICG, but also it's kind of such a metaphor of just how ridiculous and awful and horrible this entire genocide has been. Speak to those two points if you can.
Before the mechanics of the plane landing and all of those kind of things, those plane loads of people leaving Palestine confirms the idea of ethnic cleansing by death or deportation. Secondly, it confirms the idea of a genocide, the removal of a people from their land. Thirdly, that ought to be a clincher in an ICJ case. And the choice of South Africa as the destination, when you have someone who comes fairly close to being neutral, if not allied to America and Israel, Kenya, as a stopover. Countries have deals with Rwanda to deport their migrants to Rwanda, and you don't go there. Countries that have signed agreements with countries like Britain, for example. It's a very willful overlooking of where. So it is an up yours to South Africa. But it's more importantly calculated to be an attempt at breaking down South Africa's morality. And had South Africa stood on the sovereignty of its airspace, had South Africa stood on the sovereignty of its airports, had South Africa stood on the sovereignty of its territory and the sovereignty of its laws, South Africa would have been on the receiving end of a massive moral backlash engineered by Israel. That, you see, you want to take us to the ICJ, but you have no sympathy. They tried that with Egypt and Jordan, when Egypt and Jordan refused to open Rafah and the borders to the people of Gaza, because the calculus is very clear. The moment those people leave, there's no right of return. And so you are faced with a dilemma that you know a genocide is happening, but if you open the gate, you have also allowed the depopulation of Palestine. So what do you choose? And fortunately, in many cases, the Palestinians themselves said, we will not go through the gates at Rafah, because they had the Sinai Desert ready to receive. And that would cause other problems for Egypt if they allowed Palestinians into preferential accommodation in Sinai while their own people are insecure. So that's the issue with trying to morally compromise South Africa. And fortunately, when they phoned the president to say, this plane is here, what do we do? A head of state needs to also understand the impact of the rule of law. And so you weigh it up, you weigh it up, you weigh it up, and then at the end, you know that all the legality is with you, but that the morality will be against you. And so South Africa says, let them through. And we call their bluff.
And were you involved in any of the consultations with the president?
No, I was not involved in it, but I can well understand how they were thinking through it. And so, in a very kind of real way, again, the Palestinians have given South Africa a gift after many years of corruption that have infested the ANC and the government of South Africa. The Palestinians give us a gift of reconfirming our moral orientation in the world. And Israel has given us a gift by pulling those stunts, by showing the consistency of our values. Because had we blinked when those aeroplanes landed, we would have been the subject of an enormous propaganda campaign. I'm sure the Hasbara class was ready to unfold the greatest propaganda against us, because South Africa is not a political, geopolitical, military, or economic superpower, but it is regaining its moral superpower force.
Okay, we have just about 12 minutes, to, and I appreciate your time because you know you have something after this and you're on a short trip to the UK, so we won't go beyond the extra 12 minutes. But just a few more things I want to speak about. Has there been, you mean you mentioned that, you know, the US has been the primary punisher. Have there been other nations have picked up the call and picked up the phone and called your president or called various ambassadors and been like, you should consider dropping this, you should consider dropping the ICJ case or else?
There have especially been calls after the so-called ceasefire brokered between Israel
the
and...
The first one or this current one?
This okay. current one. To say there is now a ceasefire, drop the case. It's been loud from the US, but it's also been suggested from others that South Africa actually does that. I think South Africa is principled enough to know that the ceasefire is not a peace. It is just an attempt to disarm Hamas from resistance. So it's not a peace in that sense of the word where you can rebuild and where you will go back to the status quo ante as it was before October 7th, that there's a huge price to pay in land that is going to give up. It's the status quo as is. What Israel wants, it will keep. Where it pushes the Palestinians, that will be Gaza after that for Palestinians. So we know that. Secondly, we know that it is principled to continue with the case of the ICJ because we want to break down entirely the sympathy for acts of genocide, and we want to break down entirely the guilt that particularly Western Europe has for Zionism. And we also know that we need to keep the case going, and that because nothing that we do has a guarantee that we will be unpunished, that there is absolutely, there's only capriciousness. There is no consistent principle that we can calculate. If we do this, they will lift the tariffs. If we do that, they will return aid. Everything over the last few months tell us that we are dealing with capriciousness, so it is better to just do the principle thing.
I mean, and the ANC has a long history of dealing with capriciousness.
Absolutely, and our capacity to absorb punishment is a strong one. But I think that we are also having to deal with the fact that, they are anticipating the day that the ANC will be out of power, and we can't be out of power and have lost completely our moral orientation.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, it's more than 2 years since Israel's genocide began after October 7th. When October 7th happened, I mean, given what's happened in the last 14 years when Israel has showed a consistent policy of mowing the lawns by instigating attack from Hamas or another faction, and then going into Gaza and using heavy artillery to destroy homes and kill people. Did you anticipate that, you know, the viciousness and the brutality of the response will be what it has been? And what do you think? I mean, we all say, and you've mentioned a few times, that the end game is ethnic cleansing. Obviously, there's a method to the madness, and the method changes. But what do you think is Israel's current sort of game plan to ensure the ethnic cleansing? And what do you think of the response?
I don't think Israel's game plan is changing at all. I think there are different administrations that have different thicknesses of the velvet glove. And I think that we have got a bare-knuckled fighter now in Netanyahu. I think his endgame has been interrupted, but has not been thwarted. If anything, knowing what we know, that when we were on a peaceful march, and it was the biggest march that was getting the best global impact, we knew the capacity of the apartheid state to put a shooter in our midst in order to evoke the clampdown on the march. And so we're familiar with those kind of things, and therefore our hope and prayer is that there is no one in Palestine who will give Israel the last bit of impunity and permission to come in there and resume what they are doing. So, in a sense, we've interrupted the genocide, not completely, but we've interrupted it. I don't want to be pessimistic, but I think that Israel may believe that the end game in completely destroying the idea, in completely prosecuting the patricide, the killing of the Palestinian state, they think they may have achieved that, because if they confine the Gazans to one corner, the settlements and the walls and the road infrastructure, the diversion of water, the destruction of olive groves, and the steady expansion even on the West Bank of the Israeli presence, they believe that they've turned the tide towards what I call the Swiss cheese model, which is the old South African Bantustan model, that you've got an Israeli state with Palestinian holds that you need to contain. I think that they believe it, and they believe that they are on the way to an Israeli state from the river to the sea. The one thing that we have not allowed them to do is what I call the vericide, the killing of the truth. And I think that's the one trench from which we must reimagine the Palestinian struggle. That's the one trench where global opinion has swung to defeat the vericide, the massacre of the truth by Israel. And so I think that that's where we are.
Okay, final question, and we have about 4 minutes, so you know you don't. I mean, if you want to speak for 10 minutes, then it's on you. When you got involved in the struggle against apartheid in the 80s, what made you do that? What inspired you both externally and internally?
So getting involved in politics is not a career choice. And I think that there are even many Muslims in the West who say, I must carve out this path for me in politics. I must become powerful in labor or in the Democrats, and this is my path. Your involvement in politics is best when it is organic, in the sense that you are moved by a cause. You are accidentally thrown into a struggle. You are without choice about how you get involved in that struggle. And so for me, it was when I entered high school in 1976, I had my first taste of tear gas and rubber bullets and whoops from the apartheid state. And that was an induction into politics that never left me. So in a sense, the struggle must choose you. You mustn't choose the struggle. And by 1980, I was leading, as part of a collective, the school boycotts across the country, and particularly in the Western Cape. By university, I was involved in both a student organization at UCT. I was involved in the Islamic movement, but then graduated to the call of Islam, because that was a response, organic response by Muslim South Africans to affiliate to the liberation movement and to affiliate to the interfaith movement, while the Islamic movement was humming and hawing about the haramness and the halalness of those kind of moves. We just did it. And by 1990, we were having to lead our communities through the transition. And by 1994, those of us who were there had to play our role in the first generations of government. So those are a series of accidents. You don't choose. Ambition is the antithesis of the danger of the moment. If you want to say, I want to be a leader of the UDF, you are asking to be jailed, assassinated, or driven into exile. And so there was a wonderful cleansing of yourself, of ambition. And so I always joke saying that my leadership is navigated by two ahadith, two sayings of the Prophet, on whom be peace. The first one is that whenever two or more embark on a cause, the first thing they must do is to choose a leader. There must never be a leadership vacuum. Never, ever. That's the intent of that hadith. Whoever does not take leadership when they are capable of it is leaving a vacuum. That's not ambition, that's responsibility, whether there's danger or not. The other hadith is, whoever desires leadership must be denied leadership, because your ambition and your ego has overtaken you, and therefore you have already compromised your mission by putting your ego ahead. And so that was my ambiguity in leadership, and alhamdulillah, I've tried very hard to retain that ambiguity, because it kept me honest as much as it could. There have been moments of lapses when I've abdicated from leadership when I shouldn't have, and when I have striven for leadership when I shouldn't have. But by and large, those have set the defaults. And so you can't abdicate when you are 10 years old and you come home one day and the area in which you live, District 6 in Cape Town, has been declared a white area, and the bulldozers are waiting to bulldoze your home, and your parents are standing frantically looking for a truck to put on your goods and running to find a place to live in. That dispossession, that indignity, that pain in the eyes of your parents stays with you forever, and that motivates you. When you taste the tear gas, you know that you can withstand whatever they throw at you. When you face your first stint in prison, you know that this is the life that you have chosen. Even though they have sacked you as a teacher, you can make a living, an honorable living, being an activist. And when you meet Nelson Mandela for the first time in prison, in your second stint in prison, and you've endured 4 months of solitary confinement, and you've used those 4 months to get so close to the Quran, to rely totally on God, then you know that this is the life that you have chosen. And if you keep that memory alive through the good years, when you are a minister, when you are a premier, when you are an ambassador, and you always anchor yourself in the memory of the dangerous years, then you walk through the corridors of power with just enough confidence so that you stand back for no white person, no powerful person, that you never fear telling the truth, because the worst that they could have done to you, they've done to you already. But you have enough humility to know that individuals don't make history, that you've got to be part of a collective, and that you must never aspire to be a populist leader. You should always embed yourself in collective action, in organization, because individuals can mobilize, but individuals have a limitation on how they can organize, and it's organization that brings about the victory at the end.
Ibrahim Rasool, thank you so much. That was very inspiring and very nice.
Thank you very much.
Unapologetic is a show that unapologetically looks at the life, times, and views of some unapologetic and not so unapologetic humans, hosted by me, Ashfaq Karim. We hope this week's episode enabled you to learn something. Subscribe to stay connected with us. Your support means we can continue bringing you more of these stories. Until next time, goodbye.